At the end, I showed you exact results, but most of the lecture was using perturbation theory because I just wanted to make a point about sort of what Anderson referred to in that article in Physics Today as taking the electron apart. That when you see when an electron, when it behaves in a solid, doesn't necessarily behave like a simple electron. A way of illustrating that is through the spectral function. And it's a sort of a general idea, so I thought I would talk about it a little bit here. The spectral function consists of two pieces. One is for adding an electron, and one is for removing an electron. So there's the adding, and it's usually an n-body system. So the n here is really referring to the number of electrons in the system or the number of particles. So you start with a n sub e electrons, and you add one, and you go to an n sub e plus 1, or you take one away, and you go to n e minus 1. And you're basically binning, these delta functions do, you're binning the possibilities for doing that. That's particularly relevant because we can measure this in experiments, and this is through photo emission spectroscopy, it's called. By the way, this is measurable through photo emission spectroscopy, and it's removing an electron. And this is observable through inverse photoemission. And this is adding an electron. So this is a lot harder right now. The technology is not so good. This is the one that's utilized the most. And you're removing an electron, so you're only learning about states that are occupied. Okay, that's all you can learn about, because states that are unoccupied, you can't remove an electron from there. And an inverse photoemission, since you're adding an electron from the outside, you can only learn about states that are unoccupied. So this is an attempt to learn about that band structure that we discussed at the beginning of the course, to learn what states are available, where they are, and how they behave in relation to the Fermi level. Traditionally, so let me describe, here's just a schematic. It's the classic photoemission experiment. You send light in, it hits the solid, and out comes an electron, and then you measure, in principle, its energy and its momentum. Now, in practice, there's lots of limitations to this technology. For one thing, with the energies of the photons involved, it's only sensitive near the surface. So, you know, for many years, it was used as a probe to understand surface properties of materials only. But especially with the high-temperature cuprate materials in the late 80s, this technology advanced incredibly so that it became clear that people were actually able to observe bulk properties with this technique. And there is something called ARPES, so there's lots of acronyms. This is photoemission spectroscopy. And then ARPES is angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy. And in angle-resolved, you're measuring also the momentum. So you're actually trying to map out. You remember we had these bands in the Brillouin zone, and you're actually trying to map out what those bands look like. and where they're located. So this is a plot, for example, of it's that same plot I just drew on the board. It's energy versus momentum. And what you see is a band. So that's one of these bands here. And I don't know why KF is way up there, but so this axis is K and this axis is energy, then these states are all occupied. By definition of the Fermi level, these states are all unoccupied. So these are the shaded region. The shaded region here are the occupied states. This is KF right here. And then EF is this value of E right there. And as I've mentioned once or twice before, in terms of what this means when you draw these curves, it means that the spectral function is basically a delta function. Okay, and what it says is that, so this is that same curve now, but it's showing delta functions all along the way. And these are shaded in because they're occupied. These are unshaded because they're unoccupied. So this is a simple schematic of an electron in a solid, so it's in a band, but unencumbered by anything. It's free for all practical purposes. It behaves like a free electron, except it has a band mass. These, by the way, are taken from lectures at CIFAR is a Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, and Andrea Damascelli is a member of that, and he's at UBC and he does these sorts of experiments. So in fact, there's a review article from 2004 which has these in it. So here it is again. These figures you've seen, and what that's in contrast to is what happens when there are interactions. Okay. When there are interactions, you see those same peaks, there's that same band, but they're not just delta function peaks anymore. They're in general somewhat broadened. So you can see this is very broadened compared to there, but as it approaches the Fermi energy, the Fermi surface, they become sharp. That's the hallmark of a Fermi liquid, what's referred to as a Fermi liquid. So it behaves essentially like a free electron, but with different mass. On top of that, there is this other stuff, and that's referred to as incoherent spectral weight. It's incoherent because it doesn't represent anything in particular, and I'll show you an example from that calculation from last class in a couple of minutes. So you measure this, the F of omega is the Fermi function, which says that you're only going to measure occupied states with this technique, and there's this spectral function, A of k and omega. And by measuring this, you hope to learn about the self-energy. Now, we haven't said anything about self-energy. I don't know what your background is. Do you people know what the self-energy represents? Single particle. You know, okay, I asked earlier, you knew what the Green's function was, right? So the Green function is a propagator. In condensed matter, we almost exclusively deal with this propagator in wave vector frequency space. So we Fourier transform from time and from real space. We generally deal with this, which is referred to as the retarded Green's function. And this Green's function obeys a Dyson equation, okay, which is exact. And the Dyson equation is basically Let's see if I got that. Yeah. So this is referred to as the self-energy. So the Dyson equation is a perturbation theory of sorts, but this is exact. And in principle, if you calculate the self-energy exactly, then you have the exact Green function. In practice, you often do some kind of perturbative expansion, or you do some kind of approximation to get the self-energy here. And these should all have omega plus I delta. And this spectral function, this A of, I put a subscript sigma for the spin, but we don't have to worry too much about that. A of P and omega is simply minus 1 over pi times the imaginary part of this Green's function. So by doing this measurement and effectively measuring the spectral function, you're trying to learn about the real and imaginary parts of the Green's function. So the real parts enter in sort of shifting the energy. There would be a pole here. If there weren't any imaginary parts, there would be a pole in the Green's function at those energies. So again, the G0 that I wrote there for a free electron is simply 1 over omega minus epsilon k plus I delta. And this epsilon k is, you know, maybe that minus 2t cos k in one dimension for a tight binding model, for what you expect. And this I delta is an infinitesimal imaginary part. So, yeah, because you, again, the, what we deal with, so, okay, how many of you have seen Green's functions? Oh, so you've all seen them. Again, in condensed matter, we use imaginary time. Does that, how many of you have looked at it at imaginary time? Okay, so great. So what we actually calculate is the causal Green's function, which for electrons, because they're fermions, they're evaluated at this at these Matsubara frequencies. Okay, so these are multiples of pi t times 2m minus 1, and m is an integer from minus infinity to infinity. This is obtained from that through an analytic continuation. So you have to, if you're on the complex plane, you find out about this function at these discrete points, at least at finite temperature. At zero temperature, they become a line. And then there's a job to do to analytically continue this result to the retarded Green's function. And that means that you start to learn what it is along this line just above the axis, infinitesimally above the axis. And once you do that, then you can, for example, get the spectral function, which has more of the physical content. So you could right away take minus 1 over pi times the imaginary part of G naught, just, and you know the rules for dealing with these infinitesimals, and this is just delta of omega minus epsilon k. So it is a delta function, like was drawn in those figures. And it means there is a very well-defined excitation precisely at these energies. And so you're supposed to stare at that delta function and say, ah, there's an electron. Whereas over here, you stare at this sort of delta function and you say, ah, there's a quasi-particle. It came from an electron, but you now call it a quasi-particle. Okay, because it has all the features of a particle, but obviously there's more to it. There's this incoherent part, for example, and there's often a width. So for example, in condensed matter, the way widths almost always inevitably arise is through dirt. The fact that the whenever there's dirt in a material, it's kind of randomly placed. And so so actually, momentum or wave vector k is in fact not a good quantum number. It's not a translation invariant system anymore. There's dirt there. But we tend to do some impurity averaging. And what we often do is we replace this infinitesimal, or we don't replace it, but we calculate a self-energy that actually turns out to just be some constant, with which we call an inverse lifetime, 1 over tau, 1 over 2 tau. But it's not an infinitesimal anymore. And if I take the imaginary part of that function with dirt, we get one over pi times one over two tau divided by omega minus epsilon k squared plus one over two tau squared. So it's a Lorentzian. So it's a broadened delta function. And it'll start to look more like this piece of the this is not including that over there. Okay. And those are, by the way, those are referred to as coherent pieces of the spectral function. And these things over here are incoherent pieces of the spectral function. And as this expression illustrates, it can be a lot more complicated than what's over here. Obviously, if this imaginary part of the self-energy is a constant, then it's practically a Lorentzian, like I've got over here, except that this thing might have some k and omega dependence. Although there's all sorts of constraints here. For example, there are, you guys have heard of Kramers-Kronig relations?
Most likely not.
Most likely not. So there are what are referred to as Kramers-Kronig relations. They follow from causality and analyticity of the Green's functions that relate sigma double prime and sigma prime. These are not independent of one another. They have to obey these Kramers-Kronig relations. And there's all sorts of other constraints, like this spectral function, this one or the one over there, obeys a sum rule. If I integrate this thing over all omega, all frequencies, even though I don't know, you know, I may have calculated these things in some approximation, but if I integrate this over all frequencies, I better get one. Okay, so it obeys a sum rule that area represents sort of the particle. And whether it's fallen apart into a coherent piece and an incoherent piece, or whether it's still a delta function, it's still a particle, and it better sum to one in terms of its area. Okay, didn't quite mean to get into that kind of explanation. What I really just wanted to show you, and I guess I better, I'll skip the details. They're in the notes. But for the problem we did yesterday, well, maybe I should finish with this. What else did I want to say here? So this is talking about the Lorentzian and the incoherent piece, and the fact that what will generally happen is there'll be an effective mass, m star, which is greater than m. And here's that that lifetime. And I did want to, I also wanted to show you that over the years, over the decades, this is the progress that's been made experimentally. Okay, back in the 70s, that was the resolution you could measure. Okay, this is a function of energy. These are millielectron volts, so this is 0 to 200. It's going in that direction because they're occupied states, right? They're 200 millielectron volts below the Fermi surface. And you learn nothing above. So we'd like to resolve these bands, and that's as good as it was back then. The resolution was horrible, but by 2000 already, you can see the resolution had increased remarkably. And then it took another leap in about 2005. So these are versus binding energy. These are versus k, wave vector, relative to kf. So 0 is kf. And what these people, so this is kind of humorous because, well, it's not that funny. But one of the reasons for building these huge synchrotron sources was so you can do these experiments, because now you get a very intense beam of light, and that's what you need to get your signal up in these experiments. And around 2005, this group at Colorado actually figured out that if they just used their own in-house system with lasers, they could do much better. That's the one on the far left. They came down in energy. It's 6 electron volt laser as opposed to what was normally used. This resolution is still really good. It's like the better one that I showed you in the last slide. But you can see that it's remarkably improved. What are they doing here? They're mapping out on the figure I had here with that band, and here's the Fermi energy. This is K. So that picture is showing you the band right here. Okay, and showing you that there is a band. They see an enhanced signal. This is a color plot, so that brownish color means high intensity. They see nothing over here, over there, they just see intensity. They're following that quasi-particle peak, is what they're doing there. And these are pictures as a function of energy, just like on the that I showed you earlier. And they're showing you these are normal state and superconducting state. So the red is a normal state, and it's a peak right near the Fermi level, and then the blue is the same peak right near the Fermi level, but now because of superconductivity there's a gap, so that peak gets pushed to lower energy. And this is showing you where in the Brillouin zone they're looking. So it's sort of relating wave vector to energies, and showing you these peaks. But the resolution is clearly extremely good now. Okay, before I ask for the screen to go up, any questions about what you've seen there? And I might say, these experiments are doing for electrons what the neutron scattering experiments, in a sense, were doing for the phonons, except that analogy is probably pretty accurate. And they're examining the excitations directly. We don't think of electrons in a solid as excitations, but in the sense that they form these bands, they are excitations. Okay, if I could get the projector off and the screen up, please. So let me just write down, and because it's a polaron problem that we studied last time, so there's, you know, the, in some sense, the N, E here is zero. So all I can do is add an electron. So it's inverse photoemission. It's not photoemission, but you can still ask what is A positive for k equals zero is a function of frequency in perturbation theory. So this is just in perturbation theory. And you'll get Z naught times a delta function. Plus 2t lambda omega e over pi times 1 over omega plus 2t all squared times theta 2t minus And if I draw this, so here is frequency. Let's put zero there. So remember, minus 2t to 2t is kind of our band, right? That's the non-interacting picture we started with. So let me just put that in for reference. This says there's a delta function below the minus 2t. So this is E0. We calculated this last time. So I wrote that on the board last time. And that's somewhere down here. Okay, it's perturbative, so in principle lambda is really small. And it's a delta function. So in this case, it's not even broadened by this interaction. And that remains true for the polaron problem, even beyond perturbation theory. So it's a delta function, and it's the coherent piece, as I've said before, and it has weight of z0, okay, which is less than 1. But then there is this other piece, and this other piece goes all the way from minus 2t plus omega e to plus 2t plus omega e. And it has a shape that looks like this. It's slightly asymmetric because of this 1 over omega plus 2t squared factor at the front. And this represents the incoherent p. And if you remember the expression I had over on this side of the board for the wave function in perturbation theory, there was a secondary piece to just the bare C0 dagger. And that secondary piece had a phonon. And this is representative of that secondary piece with one phonon. So in other words, when you extract an electron from this band, so we're at zero wave vector right here. Because of interactions, this has moved down to here. You not only see the electron at that energy, which is represented by this E0, you also see in part, you're adding an electron here. You would also see in part spectral weight further up in energy. representing this incoherent piece. And as I said, this is in perturbation theory. That's a tiny amount. But remember the last plot I showed you on the slides last day, where, in fact, in that, and that was an exact solution, this piece was tiny. And everything was in the incoherent piece. Okay, and that's actually more representative of Polaron. As I said, you can integrate all this weight and get one, which means you can figure out what Z naught is. This Z naught, by the way, is sometimes referred to as the residue, for reasons that'll become clear in a second. So if you integrate, in fact, if you integrate over the incoherent piece, you're going to get 1 minus z naught, because the integral of the delta function is just 1. It has weight z naught, so that has weight z naught. So z naught plus this has to be 1. And if you do that integral, you can do it analytically, you will get z0 is equal to 1 minus lambda over 2 times t over the square root of omega e you'll get that. And, yep. Okay, why the spike is not coherent.
It's called coherent.
Is coherent. Okay, question is, why is the spike coherent? Well, the reason for the word coherent is that it is a spike. Now you're asking, why is there a spike there? If there were no interactions, you guys tell me so I know you're paying attention or following or something. If there were no interactions, what would I draw? Okay, Eugene, you tell me. Where?
At the energy.
Which is what energy?
Minus 2t,
yeah. You would just draw a spike right here, right? Because it's k equals 0, so it represents this guy right here, and then nothing's changed. Now, there are small number of interactions. So rather than asking me why is there this spike, you should be asking me why is there this incoherent piece. The spike is there because it was there, right? It was there in full glory right here. It had a full weight of 1. Now it's shifted a bit. That's okay, because there's some interactions. That's not too surprising. What might be surprising at first glance is that its weight has gone down from 1. And it has. And so that has gone into this incoherent piece. So I don't think it's at all surprising that a spike has remained. Now you might ask, why hasn't it broadened out into a Lorentzian? Why hasn't it deteriorated in that fashion? And I think the main answer to that is that these remain block states. Okay, they're completely coherent. Unlike in the case of impurity scattering, where now the states mix. Impurities cause scattering, and so the block states aren't good states anymore in terms of being eigenstates, if you really wanted to treat the impurities accurately. Is that... Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
So there can never be a case where it would not appear.
Where the peak won't appear.
Yes.
Yes. that's what the whole community is looking for, primarily, right? If this were a mini body example, we would say that the mini electron system remains a Fermi liquid. And that is basically saying that these spikes are still there, along with some incoherent fashion. People are interested in a new paradigm for so-called strongly correlated systems where that's not true. There is no coherent peak at all. In fact, there might be new quasi-particles that you can't see in this picture. You have to see it in a different way. And so there's a search for both theories, and there are some existing theories now where that quasi-particle peak is completely gone. Yeah, so that's definitely the case. Okay, anything else at this point? Does anybody recognize that expression? This expression is precisely M band over M star. So I think I wrote it down last time. I didn't derive it because of time, but this is precisely the inverse effective mass. And remember, they're not so different things. That's not a coincidence. So let me go back to the Green's function. Is written like this. If a shift in the real part of the self-energy is all that's important, which is the case here, and if the momentum or the wave vector dependence is not important in this self-energy, which is also the case here, at least in perturbation theory. If that's all true, then we can expand this g of k and omega. As basically 1 over omega minus epsilon k plus I delta minus sigma of omega equals 0 minus di by di omega minus omega di by di omega of sigma at omega equals 0. Then we can say, well, epsilon k plus that shift, and these are going to be the real parts of the self-energy, so we're going to ignore the imaginary part for now. That is the new ground state energy. So we'll call that E sub k. And it's just a shift. Okay? It's like that's the shift, right? We've seen it shift down. It went from minus 2t to something lower. All right? So then I can write this as, well, I can bring the omega pieces together. And then I'm going to have minus EK plus I delta. Okay, and if that all that is accurate, then I can further write this as 1 over 1 minus d sigma by d omega, all divided now by omega minus EK divided by 1 minus d sigma by d omega plus I delta. And then it looks like, what does it look like? It looks like a non-interacting Green's function, except the residue, the thing up here, that's why it's called a residue. The residue is not one. It's something reduced from one. And what's its value? Well, it's exactly the value. Remember, Ek is basically going to be h bar squared k squared over 2m, realizing there's a shift. But now I'm going to tag on this correction, which is there, and it's the same correction as the residue. So that's why we got the same answer. But it's not necessarily true beyond perturbation theory, and it's not true for more complicated electron-phonon interactions. And in particular, if the self-energy has moment, has wave vector dependence, then it's not true in general. But this says, this implies now that A of, we're looking at K equals zero, and omega, which is minus 1 over pi times the imaginary part, well, this is all real here. You use the same rules, and so you get a delta function. With that residue. So this is our Z naught, and it's Z naught that comes in and plays a role in the effective mass. So that's not a coincidence. One other thing you can do, again, having in mind what I showed you last time, is you can calculate the expectation value of the number of phonons. And that's just sum over Q, AQ dagger, AQ times omega E. And I'm going to use phi 1, which is the perturbed wave function I got last time. Yes?
From what you
got for Z naught,
when there's no self-energy, you have the Z naught being 1.
Yes.
But is there anything that prevents Z naught from blowing up? For example, if the derivative is equal to 1.
Yeah, that derivative is always negative. The derivative is always positive. Okay, so physically it's always positive. If it blows up and becomes greater than 1, you've made a mistake.
And then if it's equal to 1, then Z naught blows up.
So, sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. I said it right the first time. The derivative is always negative. It's always negative. Okay, so it can't exceed 1. This spectral function, I didn't. This, well, you can see it from here. It's positive definite. There can't be any negative pieces. So you can't have a piece that's greater than 1 and then balanced by a negative piece that's less than 0. They're all positive. It plays the role of a probability distribution for the electron. So this will always be negative. And it has a little more meaning than that. If I plot the electron, so as a function of wave vector k, if I plot n of k, then for a free electron, this is 1, and it goes to 0 at kF. This should be k here. It goes to 0 at kF. right? What happens in, so this is beyond, remember, we're doing polaron theory, which is one electron. This is many-body theory now with many electrons. What happens to this picture when you introduce electron-phonon interactions is it, if you introduce very weak electron-phonon interactions, this changes by doing this. So I should use a different color chalk. And there's still a jump, remarkably. Okay? The fact that there's still a jump here is connected to the reason that there's still a delta function in these spectral functions. There's still a jump, and that the size of that jump is 1 over 1 minus di sigma by di omega. Okay, so this jump is remember, this number here is 1. This jump is less than 1. Okay, but it's given by the size of that jump. So when this derivative goes to infinity, then the jump becomes 0, the size of the jump. Okay. Any other questions? So the last thing you can do is just, again, we're just doing perturbation theory, and I'm trying to illustrate for you that even in perturbation theory, some of the signs of what actually happens in that exact solution that I showed you are indicated. I'll just write down the answer. You get lambda over 2. So lambda is the small parameter. This is going to be tiny because we're doing perturbation theory and it's just linear in lambda. But we get 1 over square root of omega e, 1 plus 2 omega e over 1 plus omega e to the 3/2. And omega e bar here is simply omega e over 2t. So what this is showing you that as omega e goes to 0 and phonon goes to infinity. So you have to think back to yesterday's lecture at the end when I showed you the results in one dimension. This is only one dimension. And as I kept lowering the phonon frequency, the effective mass kept growing. And that was going alongside the fact that the number of phonons in the ground state was growing, as illustrated in that explicit plot that was a little hard to understand. All of these are just in the signs of what's happening when you introduce the electron-phonon interaction, in this case, to a single particle. Okay. Any other questions about this? I'm going to leave this topic now and move on to electron-electron interactions in various approximations. And that will be involved truly many-body systems. So anything more here? In the end, this is the basis of superconductivity theory as well. So if you've looked at the outline, and maybe if you want to give me some feedback, because I didn't realize you guys were reasonably versed in Green's functions, and although less so in self-energies, is that, which tells me you haven't calculated anything with the Green's functions. Like, to actually calculate something, at least in condensed matter, you have to basically calculate the self-energy. So I'm not sure what you've seen on that front. But the last lecture in the outline was sort of, I don't even know if I'm going to get there, to be honest, but there was sort of a choice in my mind of looking at Bogdi-Bob-Degen theory, which discusses inhomogeneous superconductivity. So we're going to talk about superconductivity eventually, and BCS describes really homogeneous superconductivity, but Bogle-Bob-DeGene handles the inhomogeneous case. Or the other alternative was what I refer to as Elie-Ashberg theory. And Elie-Ashberg theory is a more detailed description of BCS theory that includes the electron-phonon interaction explicitly. BCS just included it in a model way. That's kind of involved with self-energies, and you can use Feynman diagrams, but I'd actually prefer to use equation of motion. So anyways, if you've got views on that, let me know in the next day or so. Okay, so now I want to move on to, I got a thing here that I never got before. All right. Yeah, I'm not sure what that's doing anymore. I want to talk about Hartree-Fock. So, so let me remind you that the full problem involves solving this mini-body problem, which is in general pretty hopeless. Okay, so H here has a one-body part. Which consists of the kinetic energy and we'll call U sub ion. And in, at least in the discussion today and in most descriptions in textbooks. So this, by the way, is chapter 17 in Ashcroft and Merman, but there's also a chapter 2 or something in Taylor, and I think it's Heenonen, that discusses this as well. There's no phonons, okay? So when I say U ion, I mean it's actually an electron interacting with the stationary static ions. Okay, which brings me to another point, which is that this generally has in it the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, where we've essentially just fixed the ions, and we're not even going to worry about their spacing. We know what their structures are, and people can run out and measure them if we're interested in a particular material and tell us what they are, and that's where we'll lay these down if we are so desire. And then there's the two-body interaction term, which is simply E squared sum over I not equal to J of 1 over RI minus RJ. And sometimes people say I less than J, or they say I not equal to J, and they put a factor of 2 so you don't double count. So Hartree theory says, let's write, let me emphasize Hartree approximation. We write psi of R1, R2 as a product of single particle orbitals. So phi 1 of R1, phi 2 of R2, by NE of RN. This is a huge approximation. If you do that and formulate the problem with this approximation in there, you get a whole, you get NE one-body problem, which means you get one one-body problem, you solve it, and that means you've solved it for all the electrons. And that one problem is you've got the kinetic energy, you've got this potential energy from the ions, and then you've got plus integral of d cubed r prime e squared over n of r prime times phi sub I of r where n sub r prime is now equal to the sum over all j like that. Okay, so the electron density is just a sum over all the electrons at location r. The electron density at r is just given by that. So this is an approximation. Okay, and in particular, this is like a Hartree. It's been written as a one-body potential. Yes, it depends on the wave function we're solving for, and that might trick you into thinking there's some kind of rigor or equivalence of this to the original problem, because now it's actually in, you know, harder in the sense you have to iterate. But it's an approximation, and sometimes this is in a general class of theories called mean field approximations. So instead of solving the really, really hard problem of how all the electrons interact with one another, you take the philosophy that you're going to focus on one electron. And at that instant, all the other electrons are doing something. You don't know what they're doing because you haven't solved this problem. But you treat them on average, that's the mean field, and you view them as just another external potential as far as that one electron is concerned. So that's how it shows up like this, and that's the Hartree approximation. And you can solve this problem for an atom, for a helium atom if you want, or for a chemist. Used to do this. This is where it originated. And then it's actually a bit of a hard problem because you've got to take this U ion into account now. There's maybe only one or two ions, or you do a molecule. But in a solid, we further simplify and we adopt what's called the Jellium model. And the Jellium model says, I don't really want to worry about this periodic arrangement of positively charged ions. I know that there's as much positive charge out there as there is negative charge. The solid is on the whole neutral. So I just want to pretend that the positive charge is smeared out uniformly. Okay, instead of picking point by point, which is not going to be so bad. But it makes everything much simpler, because if we now assume the same for the electrons, that is, we put in plane waves here, then these two terms actually cancel, which makes sense, right? What one electron sees is going to be a uniform positive charge completely balanced by a uniform negative charge. And yeah, we didn't take, you know, doesn't interact with itself, but so it's 10 to the 23rd minus 1 instead of 10 to the 23rd. It's not going to make a difference. In which case, for a solid, for a metal, you were done. The problems didn't change anything. Okay, the energy is now just governed by the kinetic energy. These things cancel. So, oh, this is that board. Okay, I don't know how that's going to work, but let's go over here. Okay, everybody. So we need to do better, and right away, essentially, it was recognized that we need to do Hartree-Fock. And associated with Fock is Slater and even Dirac, but this is generally called Hartree-Fock theory. And what they, those three individuals, immediately recognized was that you needed these electrons are fermions. You need a properly anti-symmetrized wave function. So that psi had to be what's called the Slater determinant, which consists of. And now I'll put the spin labels in explicitly because that's going to matter. Okay, so you have to put that in there. And when you put that in there, how is it going to change things? Because now these are just, there's a sum and difference of a whole pile of these with labels interchanged here and there. But out of that does emerge what's referred to as the exchange term. So we end up with, I can write it here. We end up with minus sum over j integral t cubed r prime e squared over r minus r prime times phi of j of r prime star phi of I of R prime, phi of J of R. And this will only work if the spins of I and J are the same. So you now get, in addition to the Hock term, the Hartree term, you get this Hock term or the exchange term. And what's been exchanged is the J and I, right? If you exchange these, then this is just that term. Okay, in diagrammatic language, this is got a bubble like that, and this one has so these are propagators, and the Hartree term, so the fact there's a loop here means it's a density. The Hartree term, so if this is a spin up, then this can be spin up or spin down. Whereas in the Fock term, if this is spin up, this is spin up, and this is spin up. The fact that there's a Coulomb interaction here doesn't allow you to flip the spin. Okay, so the exchange term only works with the one that the spin has to be the same as the problem you're dealing with. I should have started off here by saying, okay, this was for spin up or for spin down, but it doesn't matter. It'll be the same, except this term has to be the same as the spin that you're dealing with. So that's the expression you get. Then, if you take as the solution phi I of R as just a plain wave like that, then that means that your label I now is really wave vector k, and the label j, for example, will just be a summation over k prime. Then if you plug all that in, the kinetic energy operator here brings down a k squared. Okay, so you get your h bar squared k squared over 2m. These cancel still. You get your energy sub k over here. But now you get, in this term, you get a mix of k and k prime. So let me just write down what you get. So this is the epsilon I. This is what you're looking for. You get h bar squared k squared over 2m. And then you get minus e squared one over v sum over k prime. Times the integral d cubed r prime e to the minus I k minus k prime dot r minus r prime. Okay. This is nothing other than the Fourier transform of the Coulomb potential. And in fact, I'm going to make the problem a little more interesting. So so instead of the Coulomb potential, I'm going to use the Yukawa potential. Because I think maybe in the tutorial, you'll do that. So I'll give you the answer to this part, but then I think you'll have to derive it and you'll have to move on to the next part anyways. So I won't actually. I won't derive it here. But you'll get minus e squared. This is just integral d cubed k prime over 2 pi cubed. Except remember when back here, and even here, I should have said it, there should have been a qualification here, right? These are only the occupied states. And even here, these are only the occupied states. That one electron that you're sort of fixating on because you're doing the mean field approximation only sees the charge of the other electrons, which are there, not the ones that are not there. So this is occupied states, which all that means for plane waves is that k prime is less than kf in magnitude. And then this Fourier transform is, well, you know what it is. It's just, it's 4 pi over ktf squared plus k prime minus k all squared. Okay, because if you take away the screening, you just get the Coulomb interaction. And then you can do that integral, and that's what you're going to do so in the tutorial. But without Thomas Fermi screening, because that's what I put in there. So I called it Yukawa potential, but we refer to it as a Thomas Fermi screening factor. Without Thomas Fermi screening, so KTF equals 0, then epsilon k is epsilon is h bar k squared over 2m minus 2 e squared over pi times f of k over kf, where, so this is capital F of x is 1/2 plus 1 minus x squared over 4x log of 1 plus x over 1 minus x. Okay. So what you're going to do in the tutorial, I think, is figure this out and plot it. If you plot it, if you plot epsilon k versus k, then there's your k squared. That's your usual, your free electron parabola. This correction, this is all exchange energy. It lowers the energy. So it goes down here, and then the thing goes up and sort of matches up at high energy with the parabola. So you should find that. Then when you plot the density of states, what happens to the density of states? So this is versus epsilon now, versus that axis, and you want the density of states. Well, this one you know, it's the square root of epsilon. That's the free electron parabola. But in this approximation, this Hartree-Fock approximation, you see I drew it a little funny here. Not a bad job. Because there's a logarithmic divergence in the derivative. The slope here is divergent. If you just take the slope of this, you'll find it divergent. Okay? And because there's a divergence there, the density of states, which goes back, it goes lower in energy. We've lowered the energy somewhere down here. The density of states actually goes to 0. So there's this funny glitch where it goes to 0 there and then comes up again, goes underneath here, and then rejoins this at high energies. Okay, and I actually discovered this for myself as a graduate student and got very excited, because if it goes to 0, that's the sign of, and that's right at KF, right at EF here. That's a sign of a metal insulator transition. Something really interesting is going on. And then discovered that it was in most of the textbooks. So everybody already knew that. But it's, and you know, and it's wrong. It's physically wrong. Well, how do you know when to decide when a calculation tells you something interesting? How do you know whether to decide it's interesting or whether it's just wrong? I'm not sure what the answer to that question is in general. But one way you can see this one's wrong is if you redo the calculation with this screening, and the screening you've plucked out of a hat at this point. The rest of the lecture, and I won't have time to finish it today, will be concerned with screening where we won't pluck it out of a hat, we'll derive it. But right now I've plucked it out of a hat. But when you include that screening, you can redo this whole calculation, and I think that's what you're going to do. And then, I better use a different colored chalk here, then all this nice interesting stuff becomes not so interesting, and the curve looks like this. Okay, it's lower than the free electron result. That's good, but not so much lower. And there is no logarithmic kink in the derivative. And so when you go to plot the density of states, it starts lower here, but then it sort of just follows the non-interacting one at higher energy. So when you include screening, which you know is there, it's physically correct, then all this wonderful stuff that might have been happening goes away. So then you know it's not. It's an artifact of the Hartree-Fock approximation, in other words, for the Coulomb potential. So you have to do more than that. You have to include screening, which is what we're going to go to next. Before I wrap that up, though, let me mention some of the historical things. So you can write this, you can write that energy in, if you use x is equal to k over kf, then epsilon k Hartree-Fock divided by epsilon f0 is just x squared minus 0.663 rs over a naught times that function f of x. So this 0.663 is simply 4 over pi square root of 3 to the power 4/3. And rs, remember rs comes from just the density being 3 over 4 pi rs cubed. So it's the mean radius of each electron. And but n is also equal to kf cubed is 3 pi squared n. So you can relate rs to kf. Okay, and then a naught is the Bohr radius that goes in there as well. So you can start writing things in terms of these quantities. And even this first term, so you can then do the total energy. So this is just summing all the single particle energies. And for this, you will get 2.21 over RS over A naught squared minus 0.916 RS over A naught. And that's in units of Rydberg. And one Rydberg is 13.6 electron volts. So around 1957, Gell-Mann and Bruckner took this and proceeded further, because this looks like a high density expansion, right? When RS is small, when this is going to be most accurate when RS is big, which is a low density. When RS is big, it's a No, sorry, it's a low, it's a low RS expansion. So when N is large, so it's a high density expansion. And Gell-Mann and Bruckner found further terms. One that went like log of of RS over A naught, and then a constant, and nowadays there are even more terms in that expansion. And this is referred, everything here is referred to as the correlation energy. So everything beyond Hartree-Fock is what's referred to as correlation, and when we say strongly correlated electron systems, we're referring to this piece beyond Hartree-Fock. Hartree-Fock takes into account kind of a trivial term, which is Hartree, and then the Fock term, which is exchange. After that, separately, the next big advance was Seppele and Adler in 1980 in PRL. So they did a quantum Monte Carlo study of this electron gas, because this is valid for low values of RS over A naught. But for any metal, RS over A naught ranges between 2 and 6. So having a low RS expansion is dubious when you want to describe something like that. So people have done high energy, high RS, or low density expansions, and that's where you get the Wigner crystallization I mentioned in the first lecture, where the thing actually freezes. But Seppele and Adler, because they're doing quantum Monte Carlo, could do all regimes, and in fact, Perdue and Zunger later parametrized these with a Padé approximant, so they took EC over N as gamma 1 plus beta 1 times square root of RS over A naught plus beta 2 over RS over A naught. So it's a Padé approximant. Padé approximant means a ratio of polynomials, and it's in the square root of RS over A naught. So this is good for high values of RS over A naught. And this is good for low values. And now the density functional theory people, remember, for density functional theory, electron-electron interactions is universal along with the kinetic energy. You only have to solve that problem once, and that's represented really by this and follow-up studies. You've solved it once, and you know it as a function of density. And that's what these expansions serve you to do. And in DFT, density functional theory, people use an interpolation between these two extremes. And those, I could write down the numbers, gamma, beta 1, beta 2, but they're just numbers. So this is all beyond Hartree-Fock, but Hartree-Fock takes you to this. Okay, the next thing I'm going to do, which will be next class, and then I will start on magnetism. So next class, I'm going to talk about screening. And so I will end up deriving, in a limiting case for screening, I'll end up deriving the Thomas Fermi approximation, which is this idea that put in this screening. This was done in the late 20s, and then later on, Yukawa used this sort of thinking to model mediating bosons with mass. And so this is sometimes referred to as a mass term. But we'll get this in a limiting case, but then there'll be a lot more than that as well. And I'll stop here for today. Any questions? Yes, Fiona.
When you say people use an interpolation between the
yes.
and DFT, can you just expand on what you mean by that?
So I haven't plotted it myself, but there are different values here. Okay, so if you you know, if you plot versus RS over A naught, so that low, so there's it goes down like this, right? It diverges. Actually, positive values, I guess. Yeah, but that's going to be valid for low values of RS. So that will do something like this, and then I don't know what it, you know, when it goes to, there are two more terms that I didn't write down here that grow with RS now. So eventually it's going to come down and you know, start doing that, if you take it all literally.
So what
that's the first expression.
Okay.
The second expression, that's valid for high values of RS second expression is valid for high values. Have I got this backwards again? Yeah, I think I've got it backwards. This one is valid for high values of RS. So really what I should be doing is that's going to zero. Okay, I'm confused. But one of them does this, and then the other one is going to do that. And now by interpolation, you're going to say, okay, I'm going to abandon those two approximations in this region and actually draw a line or a parabola or something to connect a piece of this to a piece of that, and I'm going to use that dashed curve in between.
And what is the motivation for thinking that that would be accurate in between? Like, I mean, if you know the behavior at low RS,
yeah,
and at the low ratio and the high ratio, I mean, are they just kind of drawing an arbitrary line, or?
It's in some sense arbitrary. I should plot them so I can see how arbitrary they are, but the justification is you don't believe that there is a phase transition.
Sure, so you think this is well behaved. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's, and it's going to be off, but this is what they do in density functional theory.
I guess I was just wondering what would happen if it was badly behaved, but you just go along the, like, you could check that there's no phase transition, and then you can just presume that it's low.
Check the...
Like, I mean, my main problem with it was that if it's badly behaved in the middle, that's not going to work. But
yep.
If you're just, like, once you know there's no phase transition, it's going to be low behaved.
It's an assumption,
okay.
But you have no reason to believe there'll be a phase transition in the middle.
Do you have any reason to believe there wouldn't be?
That there wouldn't be?
Maybe
it's a philosophy. There's a whole book written by Phil Anderson on adiabatic continuity, which sort of tells you that things should be connected in a smooth way if there's no phase transition. So that's the if, that there's, and people are constantly still looking at the homogeneous electron gas for ferromagnetism, for example, right? And for other phases that might have lower energy than just the homogeneous gas.
Thank you.